Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakarongo mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Duncan Smith.
Today we put our taste buds to the test on cheese made without cow's milk.
There's lots of posting going on near Seddon and Marlborough, but it's nothing to do with Facebook.
And later we head to the shores of Lake Wairarapa to listen for the call of a secretive bird, which is making a comeback.
But first, let's see what's caught the headlines in the primary sector this week. And Sally Murphy from RNZ's rural news team is with us from Ōtautahi, Christchurch. Sally, jobs on the line at MPI.
They are. The Ministry for Primary Industries is proposing to cut around 384 jobs, 40% of which are vacant, in a bid to save 7.5% of its budget. Director General Ray Smith told staff this week that MPI will significantly reduce its spend on contractors and consultants, which was nearly $58 million in the 2022-23 year, but job cuts are still required. The cuts won't affect frontline services like vets, biosecurity or animal welfare officers. MPI says consultation with staff has begun and decisions are expected by mid-May.
We'll be hearing more about that. And more ultra-dry regions in the South Island will be getting help.
Yes, a drought has officially been declared in Canterbury and Otago, joining Nelson, Marlborough and Tasman, where a drought was declared last week. The declaration unlocks support like tax relief and enables the Ministry for Social Development to consider rural assistant payments. $70,000 has also been given to the rural support trusts in Canterbury and Otago. Dan Hodgen farms sheep and beef in Harwooden in North Canterbury. He says the help is really needed.
Definitely dry, drier than a normal summer. We had a reasonable spring, so there is still some tear ground on more extensive places, but winter crops are struggling. It's certainly hard work getting anything into the ground at the moment. A lot of people holding off, a lot of people sort of taking it on faith and having a crack and drilling anyway, but nothing much really taking off. So we've still got a chance, I guess, to get decent rain before winter and get some recovery, but that window will close in the next sort of 3 to 4 weeks, I guess.
Now, this very dry weather is also leading to other problems. Creeks and streams are drying out, I hear.
They are. Green Street Creek near Ashburton ran dry this week, killing fish, eels and freshwater crayfish. Now, this is despite locals and farmers trying to raise the alarm with the Canterbury Regional Council for weeks. On Wednesday, the council said pumping water into the dried-up creek was not a straightforward request and would only be a temporary solution. But just a day later, on Thursday, the council's chief executive gave farmers the green light to pump water into the stream. Local farmer Daryl Butterick says it's great ECAN has finally seen sense.
We're very grateful, but should have happened 3 weeks ago. You know, it would have saved a lot of the wildlife in that creek. But hey, at least they've finally come to their senses and allowed us to do it. Probably something to do with a little bit of egg on their face. Or actually, to be fair, probably the whole chook. Way they handled it.
Mr. Butterick began pumping water into Green Street Creek on Thursday afternoon, and it's beginning to flow again.
So what does Environment Canterbury have to say?
Well, the council's chief executive wasn't available for an interview this week, but in a statement, Dr. Stephanie Rexiker says she's aware of the community's frustration and acknowledged the council hadn't kept locals informed. She made the call to allow water to be diverted into Green Street Creek, but didn't really give a reason as to why. She says the diversion fixes the current situation, but future conversations about the needs and interests of the community and environment need to be had in the face of climate change.
No doubt the drought's continuing to affect livestock sales.
Yes, well, about 1,100 beef weaners were sold in Temuka this week. These are the younger cattle who've been weaned off milk and are grazing pasture. The sale isn't usually held until after Easter, but farmers are struggling with dwindling feed and wanted to offload excess stock.
And what's happening in the horticulture sector?
After the impacts of Cyclone Gabrielle, apple growers had been hoping for a comeback year, and feedback about the earliest exportable apple variety, A1, has been very positive in China and Vietnam. Early signals from Europe are also positive, especially from Germany. Now, Tomatoes New Zealand chair Barry O'Neill says the season started well with good prices for growers, but with lots of tomatoes now in the market, prices have dived. And just before I go, some news about the Kaimanawa horse muster next month. The Department of Conservation is working to remove 230 horses from the Kaimanawa range in the central North Island. However, there are concerns the cost of living will see fewer people take on the horses. Only a handful of applications have come through ahead of the muster.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Sally.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Now, you might remember a story from 2022 about a small startup with big plans to rethink the way we consume dairy. Daisy Labs' aim is to make dairy products with the same taste and mouthfeel as cow's milk, but without any cow input at all. Their trick is a technique called precision fermentation, and co-founder Emily McIsaac explained it to me back then.
Precision fermentation is basically where you take a microorganism, a microbiological host, and you ask it to produce a particular protein. So in this case, we're asking it to produce bovine or cow's milk identical proteins, so things like casein and whey. We insert a small piece of DNA that encodes for this protein that we're wanting it to produce. And then basically it is like fermentation as we know it for traditional products like beer, except instead of gobbling up sugars and making ethanol, our microorganism is making that protein that we've asked it to produce. We then extract the protein out and we can use these proteins to reformulate them into dairy identical products.
Products like ice creams, yogurts and cheese. Now, there's plenty of vegan or dairy-free alternatives out there already, but Emily says taste is the key.
The alternatives that are currently on the market obviously don't contain any dairy proteins. So they don't have your whey proteins, they don't have your casein proteins. And whey and casein that come from cow's milk provide dairy products with the characteristic texture, taste, nutritional profile that we as consumers know and love. The current alternatives don't have any of that. We're providing a dairy identical protein, so a whey protein or a casein protein that we can reformulate into cheeses, milks, ice creams to give them the same texture, the same taste and the same nutritional profile as traditional dairy. We just haven't had to get our proteins from a cow.
So how soon could we see some food products on the shelves?
We're still probably a good couple of years away from seeing these products on the supermarket shelves. But yeah, we've made huge progress in the last couple of months. So if we can continue forward at the same trajectory, you never know.
Well, it's been about 18 months, and while Daisy Lab products haven't yet shown up on supermarket shelves, they do have something to show off. A week ago, Daisy Lab held an invitation-only event at their lab in Auckland to show off some prototype products. And Justin Gregory was there. Now, Justin's with us. What was on offer?
Some good stuff on offer, Sally, I promise you. And we'll get to that. And I also spoke to Emily McIsaac and asked her for an update on where Daisy Lab was at.
18 months ago, we were dreaming of this day. We had achieved expression of dairy-identical proteins in the lab, but this was very small expression. We've since moved into our own lab space. We were previously renting bench space. We now have our very own lab space, and we have a suite of fermenters which we are using to produce dairy-identical proteins.
Now, just a reminder, dairy-identical means that these are completely synthesized proteins made in the lab by Emily. they are so close to real dairy proteins that people who are allergic or intolerant, you probably shouldn't try them, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Even though they are now in the shape of food that you definitely recognise and definitely want to try.
Tonight we have, for sampling, we've got some ice cream, some yogurt, we've got some cheeses as well. What we're really focusing on scaling up at the moment is beta-lactoglobulin, which is a whey protein. So it's better suited for things like soft cheeses, but mostly ice creams, yogurt, sports and nutrition. Where we see this technology having real impact is not necessarily in the kind of high-value niche consumer products, but it's actually as in a silent ingredient. You know, when you flip over a chocolate bar and it says milk powder, no one knows that it's come from clean, green New Zealand and, you know, organic whole milk. It's just milk powder. No one knows the process that it's been all stripped down and then shipped overseas and then built into this biscuit. So we see having the biggest impact is actually targeting those kind of commodity markets. In the meantime, we obviously want to get the word out about this protein. We want to share it with consumers. We think vegan and non-vegan alike. It allows particularly non-vegans that don't want to compromise on taste and texture that they're so used to with dairy products. It kind of offers a solution to them to say, yeah, try this product that has the flavour profile you like, it has the texture you like, but it hasn't had to come from a cow.
So how long until people can buy some, Justin?
I asked, and Emily said if she was feeling optimistic, she'd say maybe
18 months?
18 months, yeah. Daisy Lab now want to raise funding to move to the next stage with a custom-built facility so they can start producing at scale. Now, they're hopeful that their product's price point will be comparable with dairy products from cows, but as we've said, the real comparison is going to be made in the mouth of the consumer. In short, does it taste like dairy?
Yeah, so does it?
You're about to find out. I stepped out of the party to share some cheese and crackers with Irina Miller. She's the CEO and one of the co-founders of Daisy Lab, along with Emily McIsaac and Dr. Nikki Freed. And alongside us was also their cheesemaker or curdologist, Cheryl Reynolds.
Okay, so you have a ash camembert, which has got a base of cashew and miso, and precision fermented whey added as a added ingredient. It's taken about 7 weeks to cultivate into the food that it is today. It's been turned every day. And beside it, you have a cashew blue, which is the alternative vegan blue cheese that vegans go to. And this one has added Daisy Lab precision fermented whey added to it as an added ingredient.
And is the process of making it pretty much the same as making ordinary cheese?
Absolutely. It's very much the same as making an ordinary vegan cheese, right, with a whey as an added ingredient. I did a taste test with the other cheese that you haven't got here.
Oh, really? A blind taste test?
A blind taste test. So I made the vegan, pure vegan. It's with tofu and coconut and loads of nuts and drop of Grand Marnier and some fruit. And I did exactly the same with the precision fermented whey. 100% everyone that tasted it just preferred it for the creamy mouthfeel and the fullness of it. It's a delicious additive.
Well, look, we have some cheese in front of us. We've just been talking about. Can you join me? Shall we try some, please?
Shall we?
All right. So what are we carving up here?
We're carving up the ash cashew camembert, which is, it's got a layer of ash in between. If you can see, there's a line of ash.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got the white bloomy mould around it. So if you'd like to take a little taste of this.
Thank you. And if you guys want to try it.
And you would like to.
I'll just do it.
Okay. And I'll do it like
there
that.
There we go.
Mm. How does that taste to you?
That's fabulous. That's really good. Thank you. And how about for you? Your first taste of it?
I love it. I mean, I'm a vegan, so I don't eat dairy cheese at all, so this is amazing.
And it's the creaminess, isn't it?
It's
the creaminess,
yeah.
The mouthfeel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just goes so... So this has got miso in it, cashew, and all the molds that go into making a traditional camembert, plus the precision fermented whey. and it just gives it that extra just beautiful creamy richness.
Gosh,
that
the skin on it is absolutely amazing. Mm. The white mold around it.
Okay, so, and now the blue.
This is blue. And are you a blue cheese lover? Some people love it, some
blue
people
cheese lover. Yeah.
Okay. So it was interesting seeing how the blue cheese performed, because I have a control cheese for each of the cheeses that I've made, and the blue cheese that is with precision fermented whey has just a different color and a different sort of texture. So it was really interesting watching how they matured over the last 2 months in the cheese cave.
All right, well, please, after you.
Well, yeah, that's a very good blue cheese. Wow.
It's delicious again.
It is, isn't it?
Well, look.
What fun.
Sounds like the precision fermented holy vegan cheese passed the Justin Gregory taste test. So did it taste dairy identical?
It sure did, Sally.
Looking forward to trying it myself. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
We're heading to Marlborough's wine country, where a startup is busy repurposing damaged vineyard posts that were used to hold up the canopy into low-cost sustainable posts for farm fencing. Repost is the brainchild of Greg Coppell. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is with Greg and one of his clients, Tracy Marshall, from Pernod Ricard Winemakers, one of the country's leading wine companies with over 2,500 hectares of grapes.
We're at our Triple Bank vineyard in Seddon. We're down at the repost site, down towards the Awatere River, and here with Greg and the repost team.
Tracy is Pernod Ricard's sustainability manager for its New Zealand operation.
In a fast-changing world where the use of resources and circularity is so important, finding solutions for various waste streams is one of the key challenges that we're facing.
This is where repost comes in, because many vineyards, like this one, have stockpiles of damaged wooden posts.
There are times when posts get broken, either by just age or wear, weather events, but also very, very significantly if it's bumped by a tractor or the harvester. Mm. Over any given year, you can see up to 4% breakage in some vineyards. And yeah, when you look at the size of the industry in Marlborough, that's a lot of posts. We're talking millions of posts out there.
Mm. So how did you meet Greg from Repost?
Marlborough is very collaborative. There's a lot of discussions and sharing of information, and we became aware of reposts a couple of years ago and were very interested. We've been stockpiling broken vineyard posts to avoid sending them to landfill. We have an ambition of zero waste to landfill, so we've got some quite large piles of broken posts that have just been waiting for this solution.
Thank you very much, Tracy. Now, Greg, what a journey you're on with this business.
It's been a journey, all right.
Now, you are a farmer.
Yeah, I'm a farmer from St. Arnold. That's the Nelson Lakes in Tasman. Probably less of a farmer these days than I'd like to be, but...
Yeah. What, sheep and beef?
Sheep and beef, yep, 500 hectares.
How did you come up with this idea? What prompted it?
Yeah, I brought those 500 hectares maybe 6 years ago. And had a hell of a lot of fencing to do, and me and the old man have been plucking posts out of Marlborough for quite some time, and I wished that somebody did it for me, as in I could go down to Marlborough and buy posts for $3.25 and I could get them in the ground instead of paying $10 or whatever. But no one was out there doing it, and I got sick of pulling nails and grinding off nails, so I started building a machine, and it just sort of grew from there. And with Stu Dudley, who's a local viticulturalist, and went and seen him and said, "You help me out and we'll give this a go together."
So you had a good contact in the viticultural industry, and that helped you connect with people who possibly had posts that were surplus to requirement.
Yeah. Like, without Stu, there's just no way it would have come together. It's about educating, and I had no idea about vines or grapes or how the industry works. And mate, he got on board and with a bit of passion and managed to sell what we're trying to achieve. And it's just ticking two boxes really, with taking waste but then also selling it to the agri sector and helping them along the way, because that's tough as well.
We've been waiting for this solution to come along for a long time. We knew eventually there would be a solution, which is why we, you know, we refused to send any of this waste to landfill.
So how does it work? Does the vineyard pay Repost to repurpose and remove the posts, or does Repost buy them from the vineyard?
We pay for the processing of the posts. It is quite cost effective compared to alternatives of landfill, but it's a decent price.
So if it wasn't for the wineries paying, so they pay about 80% of landfill costs, if it wasn't for that, this business would not work. It wouldn't stack up. We've got to be able to sell a product at the end at a low cost. So you've got to hit the market well to get that demand for the processed product, I guess. So that was part of Stu's role, is educating, and then actually most vineyards get it. They know that, oh, it's cost me 80% of landfill costs. That's not without the logistics of getting it to landfill.
So, which is a lot as well.
Oh, it's a hell of a saving for them, and we can bring that through to our end sale price,
So what was the first vineyard that you started repurposing and broken posts on?
It was one of Stu's sites up the back blocks of the Archery. That was on a Villa Maria site, and then we went from there to a few contract growers, Yealands, Pernod, and there's not one winery or vineyard in Marlborough that we are sort of not involved with now, I don't think. A few contract growers missing, but all the big boys, yeah.
The news spread fairly quickly.
Yeah, but we are 3.5 years in. This last 12 months, my wife's got heavily involved with the business, and she's sort of taken that visibility of the company up. So now we're out there, and I guess we're very proud of what we're doing, so we're being pretty loud at the moment.
And last year you won an award at the Marlborough Environment Awards. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I'm not much of an awards or that type of person, but my wife pushed us into it, and we won the winery section, and it was bloody good. You know, it was a pat on the back. Lots of people there from the industry, and
good for networking.
Oh, it was. People were lining up to talk to you, and you realise that you're onto something and you're doing something good, and people believe in you, which is pretty good, because you know, the first couple of years are pretty bloody lonely.
Mm. Was it easy to sell the idea to farmers who want posts for their farm?
Yeah, because they're cheap, and you know, it comes down to dollars. And yeah, definitely the mum and dad type of farmers are all over it. There's nothing wrong with these products. We've had them tested. All the data backs that up. We put a warranty on them as well. Yeah, these are good for 50 years plus.
So how much cheaper are they than if someone was to buy a new post?
It varies a little bit because of what the vineyards were off, because there's a different variant and sizes of posts. But yeah, I'd say about half the cost.
Now that sound in the background is the Repost crew recycling broken posts using machinery fixed onto custom-made trailers. It's quite a mobile setup.
Yeah. So when we first started, we were cruising around with a three-axle truck trailer with a tractor towing it, and we were loading an in-feed with a telehandler. But now we've realised we want to be as mobile and flexible as possible, so we can move to smaller vineyards and you know, likes this one. This is a really good site for us, because it's we've got two machines running here.
I guess you can get through quite a few posts in one day.
Yeah, some sites we go good. We'll do 1,000 plus a day. And sometimes we might go to a real mongrel of a site and we might be doing 420. Things are pretty tidy around here, but you'll go to some that they, you know, it looks like it's set up for a bonfire and you've got to pick through it, and it makes things very slow going. Yeah.
So what are the team actually doing with the posts?
They will pull the nails at it, dock it to whatever length they're going to get it. It's either a 1.8, 1.6, anything shorter is getting put in another rack, and they'll be grading as they go. Anything that's looking pretty ugly will go get turned into battens or make a decision on that, yeah.
The posts here are quite long. They look like they're over 2 metres.
So the posts that get driven for the rows to make the hold up the canopy, they're 2.4s. So some of them get pulled out, they've got a fracture in them. They come out as one hole, so they're a 2.4 length, but generally they come out at about 1900, 1800. Mm. Yeah.
Well, should we head down and see how it's all going?
Yeah, sounds good.
The posts have been stockpiled at the bottom of the vineyard and are covered in weeds.
We've been stockpiling these for a very, very long time.
How many posts do you think we can see in front of us?
I'd hate to guess, but I'd say there's 20,000 perhaps. But what we can see, what we're looking at right now, they've made quite a dint in the pile already.
Yeah, probably done about 10 or 15,000 out of here at least. So, yeah, we've just brought in another crew to push things along.
Yeah, so they're here for a while.
It's a good site. That's what we like. We like staying put, doing some good hours, good solid hours of processing.
Now, you've got 5 or 6 people here.
Yep, there's 5 on this side at the moment. We've got a few others floating around doing a few bits and pieces. So we employ, I think, 9 here in Marlborough, and we've also got a crew up north in Hawke's Bay that are doing cyclone work. So we started getting overseas workers, and yeah, we've got a really good supply of labour now.
Your staff each have a drop saw, a large drop saw.
It's all very simple. We try and run as small, we're fully mobile, so that means we're running as smaller generators, as smaller hydraulic pumps as we can. That's around just efficiency.
How do you get the nails out? Because they're not using hammers, are they?
Yeah, we'll cruise around here in front of the loader and we'll have a look at them processing those.
Gosh, there are a lot of nails and hooks and things in the posts, aren't there?
So 12 to 14, but can be more. And you'll see that the variant in them. There's plastic clips, there's 6-gauge nails, there's tech screws. It's pretty ugly, but hydraulic press grabs them and pushes the post away. And you're left with hopefully a reasonably clean nail, post. And the mind-blowing thing is we fill up a tote tank of nails in 4 days.
Well, let's stand back a bit because it is quite noisy here. Greg, we're standing in front of some posts that you've repurposed.
Yep.
Do you know where those are going to yet?
A lot of 1.6s will go to Southland, so I imagine they're heading down Southland way. They've all got homes before they even processed. Yeah.
You've got some big end posts here. The full rounds. What do you do with those?
So they are strainers. They come from redevelopment. So you pretty much have about 2 to 3% redevelopment every year. So we got 40,000 hectares of vineyards in Marlborough. So there's quite a lot of vineyards getting pulled out and put back in, either different varieties or different configurations. So there's about 200 odd thousand sound posts that come out. But the strainers are all covered in wire. So we clip the wires off it, clean them up, and make sure they're tidy and they can go out as well.
Yeah, because those strainers cost a bit, don't they, new?
I think they're about 40 or 50 bucks now, I think, or might even be more plus GST, yeah.
And what do you sell them for?
I think they're about 20 bucks.
Now, you are involved with the Hawke's Bay Silt Recovery Task Force, is that right?
Yeah, so they engaged us to come and help with the CCA treated timber out of their waste stream. So we've been up there for 4 months processing the damaged orchards and vineyards up there, yeah.
How's that going?
It's a tough gig up there. It's a mess, really. I forget what the numbers are, but it'd be 500,000 damaged posts there, mixed amongst extend-a, wire, trees, rubbish, hazardous chemicals, sheds, everything, vehicles, everything. But so it's been pretty tough going. You're dealing with absolutely broken landowners and the like. But all the material we're processing is being donated to the community up there and the farmers up there to recover some of their fencing. But it's a bloody mess, yeah.
Greg Coppell there from Repost at the Triple Bank Vineyard in Marlborough. Cosmo was also talking to Tracy Marshall from Pernod Ricard Winemakers. And you can see some photos of Greg and his team on the Country Life webpage.
I'm John Whittaker, the flower man from Fielding, and you're listening to Country Life at RNZ National.
It was nearing dusk when I pulled up on a side road on the eastern side of Lake Wairarapa during the summer. A good time to try and spot an endangered bird whose distinctive call is not so rare these days. More and more, there's a chance to hear the booming call of this secretive and lonely Australasian bittern, which nests among the tall raupua or bulrush there. Waiting for me are two members of the Wairarapa Moana Wetlands Project, biodiversity advisor Sarah Jane Jensen and pest expert Steve Plale.
A
it's a good time of day to be here because everything's coming back from hunting and gathering. So we've got a few colonies of spoonbills, which is awesome. It's about 250 of them there now, which is really exciting.
Sarah Jane Jensen is part of a team working on protecting and improving this special place right at the bottom of the North Island. 9,000 hectares of lakes and wetlands.
Two lakes, two rivers, probably about 30 or 40 wetlands. Yeah, it's a huge space.
We're looking out on one of those wetlands at the moment. Tell us about this one.
This one is called Boggy Pond. Not the best name, could do with a wee bit of a rebrand. But this is one of our easier to access sites to really get a good look at one of the parts of the Ramsar, so the internationally recognised wetlands. And we're looking at raupo cabbage trees that are making their way through, but 10 years ago you would have been looking at a forest of willows. So we would not have been able to see the water at all. And you can sort of see the sort of skeletons.
The remnants of the trees are there, just lying dead
yes.
in the water.
And our birds love them. I think they'll miss them when they go, but hopefully by then we'll have kahikatea and cabbage trees and things we've planted coming up. So, yeah, shags and the spoonbills quite like them.
Now we're actually looking for something special and we're hoping to hear something special this evening, aren't we?
Yes, yeah, we're quite lucky. We've got a population of Australasian bittern, which are nationally critical, which is the last step before extinction. So they're in the same camp as the kakapo and the wandering albatross. I think they're one of 18 in that sad club, but they're all seemingly doing okay here now, which is really exciting. So we had a few years where we saw what was a rapidly declining population of only 8 male bittern. We watched that stabilize, we stopped seeing it decline, and in the last 2 years we've seen it go up. And this year I think at these wetlands our ornithologist Shane Cottle found 19 males and 6 more at a few other wetlands that we also contract him to come in and monitor, which is really exciting. So I say males because they're the only ones that really make much noise, and they're very, very hard birds to spot, hence why we're going to try and listen for them. They're perfect raupo or bulrush hiders, and they have a freeze response. So they quite literally freeze with their head straight up in the air and they look exactly like a stick.
So pretty hard for you to spot even with your binoculars.
Yes, yep. I've probably seen 3 or 4 since working around these wetlands. I've heard more, lots more.
How long are they here for?
They're permanent residents here.
Permanent residents?
Yes, yes.
They're not migratory birds.
They don't move, they don't seem to move too much between locations, so they'll sort of quietly migrate around. So if you're a chick and you've been kicked out by mum eventually and off you go to find your new spot, they might sort of venture a wee bit further, but they don't seem to really take off and go and find wetlands much, much further away. They're also found in Australia. Like many of our birds, they sort of floated here or flew here on accident and established. They look like herons in the air, but just a bit boxier. There's only a few wetlands with stable populations left, and I think only one other where they've seen an increase. And I can't remember where. I was talking to a birdie about it, and he was saying, we've got the only population on the rise. And I went, no, you don't.
What are the threats to them?
Predation is a really big one. They're very vulnerable nesting on the ground. They make these little sort of perches or platforms, and the females will sit on the nest, and they are just a nice big egg. So they'll be a good target for predators, namely mustelids, and cats are the big targets. And we seem to have been getting good numbers of those.
In New Zealand, mustelids consist of weasels, ferrets and stoats. They were introduced in the 1800s to control rabbits, but are now a problem of their own.
Anything in there? Someone's actually set that
one off. Steve Plale has been in the pest control business for more than 4 decades and has been setting traps here for 10 years.
What sort of numbers have you been catching, Steve?
In the early stages of the trapping program, we were catching predominantly cats and ferrets with huge numbers of hedgehogs as well. They're a predator that's very underrated. But yeah, you're talking about numbers. I was lucky.
You've got some paperwork there.
I dug out some reports that I'd written. So the first year that we implemented the program down here, I'll just give you some figures. Yeah, 20 wild cats, 60 ferrets, 2 stoats, 18 weasels, 87 rats, 169 hedgehogs, 70 mice, 10 magpies, and 4 rabbits. Wow. So that was in the first year.
It's a smorgasbord for them, I suppose.
It is, and the wetlands, because they have such a diverse range of wildlife, particularly birds and things, it's just a food bowl for predators, really. And the wetlands here are surrounded by farmland, so it's just it's an open area for predators to move back in, which is one of the reasons why we just have to keep the trapping going. And it's taken us a long time to get the numbers down to where we've got them at the present point in time, where I believe it's manageable, but you can't take your foot off the brake.
So Steve, have you got some trap lines along here?
Yep, there's traps every couple of hundred metres all the way along this stop bank. This has always been a good area to catch predators along here. And one of the things that actually makes it quite good too is that they mow this periodically, so it creates quite a good runway for small pests to run up and down on. So they're not
perfectly made track for them.
Yeah,
little highway.
That's right. So as soon as they levelled this bank off and got it established years ago, I got my trap line in here straight away, and it's been quite successful, and still is. It's a trap. We've got a trap just here.
Anything in there?
Someone's actually set that one off.
So on the right is the Opurua spillway. So this is part of us trying to control nature a wee bit. The Ruamahanga River was channelised and now bypasses the lake where it would naturally have flowed in. This is a spillway, so we're standing on a stop bank. We can see the stop bank on the other side. And when we do get floods, which we did have a good one last year, that spillway can open up, take the pressure off the river, and then it goes to Lake Wairarapa. So it has been grazed because it sort of keeps that really tall grass down. It's been retired from grazing, same as Wairio wetland on the other side has had grazing in it, and that's been removed. And we can sort of see some of the plantings popping up here from a couple of years ago.
The cabbage trees
popping through. And that was with a primary school, and with Ducks Unlimited, they do lots of really good planting days through here, and we've fenced that off, and we're planting pretty big numbers. So the Wairarapa Moana project has been able to put in 35,000 plants in Kahutara wetland, which connects to this one. And the planting that Ducks Unlimited has been doing, and that pulling the pressure off grazing, there's a lot of natural rewilding, which is really cool to see.
Very satisfying.
There's been some wet paddocks, but you can see desperately where all these wetlands are trying to form again and where that water really wants to be sitting.
What's that we can hear?
That is a black-backed gull. So there are a nesting colony of those on Onoki Spit, which is a sand spit at the very southern end, and that is our most southern area the project looks after.
How many species of bird are here?
So many. There's a group that have been doing a wading bird count since 1980-something, so for 40 years they've been coming in, walking the whole length of the eastern side of the lake with scopes and binoculars counting, and what they've been able to show of the diversity of rare species is a big reason why we've been able to get that Ramsar international status, because it really is a home to so many birds, so many vagrant ones. We saw a glossy ibis for the first time here, like a bin chicken, but a black one.
What's a vagrant bird, by the way?
A vagrant bird is one that will move around. So they'll fly around. There's Canadian geese that come in as well. There's plenty of ducks. I think if anyone's known of the Wairarapa Moana or been here, it's most likely because they've been duck shooting here. It's a real paradise for duck shooters.
Now, you've been hunting here as well, haven't you, back in the day?
Yes, I've been a duck shooter for over 40 years. Boggy Pond and Matthews has a lot of history in my family. My grandparents used to duck shoot here in the 30s. My father duck shot here. He introduced me to duck shooting down here, so I've had a long...
Let's head over to the other side of the lake now to reflect on how the return of the bittern comes at an important time for local Māori. It's a little windier on this side, where a sliver of native bush among the farmland meets the rough water slapping against the shore.
Kia ora koutou. My name is Rawiri Smith, and I'm a kaitiaki and a kai mahi or a worker for my iwi, which is Kahununu ki Wairarapa.
Ra has deep knowledge of this place and its inhabitants, including the elusive bittern, the Matuku Hurepo.
They have a booming voice that they have, and so I imagine that in a choir they would be the baritone or the bass. Would be their kind of space in the what we sometimes call the dawn chorus of birds. And so the Matuku is a special type of bird, and referenced in Waiata too as being a lonely bird. And they are really secretive birds that have a whare where they live that has to have three sides surrounded so that they push back into the bush, and so that behind them and on the sides is covered with pretty thick plant life. They have to compete actually with pests like rats and mice and a whole range of different pests that attack the eggs.
How prolific were these birds pre-farming times?
They still were a minority bird and often referred to as a lonely bird. And so there wasn't a whole lot of the birds, but I would say that there was greater competition for the habitat that's wetland.
This year, the Moana, including the wetlands, returns to local iwi, part of the Crown's redress for decades of wrongdoing that meant local whānau became alienated from their culture, language and land, including the lake.
And so our lake is very important to us, and that many of the different hapu or the many different sub-tribes came to the lake and fished here, came together as people here. And this is our food basket or the pack and save of early Māori traditional time.
For 16 years now, Mana Whenua have been working with the local and regional council and the Department of Conservation to restore the Moana after more than a century of damage. The stop banks, spillways and river diversions built in the 1960s and 70s were great for farming, but tough on biodiversity.
We would love to see a flourishing habitat for birds, especially native birds and endemic birds. We'd love to see a space that has place for native fish and endemic fish and migrating fish. Our fish, in terms of tuna, go from here to Tonga. Our birds sometimes go to the Caspian, turn to the Caspian Sea. Others go to the Arctic Circle. And so huge amount of travelling that our area can host. And so one of the things that we say about Wairarapa Moana is that we want to see the pua waitanga. So pua wai means the blossoming, and tanga is the concept of blossoming. So if we can realise the potential of the lake, so our lake shouldn't just be for attenuating floodwaters, it should be a habitat for travelling birds, should be a habitat for tropical fish like tuna that have come all the way as glass eels into our waters here in the Wairarapa.
And we're making our way across the edge of the wetland to an area we're hoping to hear the sound of the Australasian bittern.
I figure our best shot will actually be as we're walking through the Raupo. They'll sort of freeze until they think you're just about to be upon them, and then they'll flush. So this will probably be our best shot at seeing them, and then hopefully they start booming. But nature, it's never on cue.
The ropo, the bulrush, is head high. Perfect habitat for the bird.
It's a really important plant species, and it's had a bad rap, and it was burned and cleared for pasture, and now it's protected, which is great.
And it's basically a hiding place.
Oh, definitely, yeah. As well as Harakeke, so a lot of the Wellington region will have just been forests of these carex sector, the grasses, the rushes, the ropo, and the Harakeke, and it will have been a really major resource for Māori. I know it was for Kohanui Marae, which is the local marae to here, Harakeke and tuna were two of the big trading items. And they've just come back. I mean, there are a few stop banks that we mow so that people can walk and enjoy the wetlands and to be able to service the traps. And you can see the ropo trying desperately to pop up through the grass, so they're really coming away.
What would the bitterns be feeding on?
The sort of meal ticket item would be baby eels or alvers. The tuna would be the absolute favourite. But around here it would be mudfish. We've got these crazy looking things called tadpole shrimp, which look like somewhere between a tadpole and a shrimp. Baby fish. There would have been further at the bottom of the lake, there's patiki as well that come up that far. Mallet even come up this far up the lake. We're pretty far inland, so there's some sort of estuarine species that get up this way as well. Enanga, so the white bait, will be a real, real big meal item for them too. So fish passage is intimately connected with the wetland, and we're lucky that our fish passage team at G-Dub are in my team, so we work quite closely together.
What about the tuna, the eels? Are they coming back?
It's really, really hard to say. I think one of the areas that we've recognised as a big hole in our knowledge here is the status of fish, and we are really wanting to kick into more fish monitoring. The oral history here and the photographs of tuna being lined up on fences and dried and eaten, it was the big trading item. I think it was probably one of the most famous eel migrations, and they just build up at the bottom of Lake Ōnoki and wait for that sandbar to burst.
And the Lake Ōnoki is just below Wairarapa, isn't it?
A very, very big lake.
Feeds into this
Yes, yep. And so with the manipulation of rivers and streams and adding bridges and culverts and things, we've made their ability to make their way back up to their ancestral streams quite hard. So it's really hard to say. A lot of the ones we are finding when we net are of a certain size and a certain age, and that can sort of tell you that there might have been periods of time where they can't make their way up, or when flap gates are closed, they can't make their way up. So we're trying to one bridge and flap gate at a time help them that way. We don't know if their population is still declining. It's the big question mark, really, and it's something we need to be doing a lot more for. So any stick that might catch your eye, just double check it, because it's probably our best shot at spotting bitten, as they just look like a pale stick poking right up out of the ground. And that the head is straight up in the air, they're just like a pin. It's quite cool. But if something catches your eye, definitely have another look.
I'm keeping my eyes peeled for the stick.
Manifesting bitten.
Sadly, there was no bitten spotted, despite our best efforts, so we head to a platform just built for bird spotting.
Climbing up
to get a better view, and now we can look out. Plenty of swans.
Yeah, yes, more than I'd like, but it's the thing that always surprises me is just the sheer mass this valley is, and the two lakes and rivers and wetlands. It's a really, really big area. And there's many endangered birds that will have been here forever and remained here, and it's one of the few pockets left. So for many, it will have been their last refuge. And then as that's been protected and the lake levels have been kept at a place to support them, birds are coming back, and it's really exciting. And for the bittern especially, it's a keystone species. Having them here is a really big deal. And having their population double over 10 years is really exciting because it shows us that we're doing good. And it's, you don't often get that payoff in conservation. You know that there's a long goal and you're told if you come back here in 20 years, you'll see this forest or tree developed. But just in 10 years of removing the pressures of willow to let the raupo come through and mostly trapping, keeping those predators back, they've doubled. They've gone from this is a plummeting population, we're watching it go extinct, to doubling it. It's massive. It's really exciting.
Sarah Jane Jensen of Greater Wellington. You also heard from Steve Plale and Rawiri Smith. The Wairarapa Moana Wetlands Project is a collaboration between Ngāti Kahununu Ki Wairarapa, Rangatane o Wairarapa, the South Wairarapa District Council, the Department of Conservation and Greater Wellington. It was set up in 2008. Sorry you didn't get to hear the bittern in that story, but we did find one in the RNZ Bird Call Library. Take a listen. And there's a snippet of the bird in a video on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/countrylife.
Well, that's all we've got time for. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Bye now.
Ka kite anō.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.